Today I'm preaching something I've never preached before in my life.
David and Goliath. It's like, if you ask anyone on the street, what story do you know in the Bible? Chances are this is going to be one of their top three, if not their top one. Because this is the story that people remember, David and Goliath. But
I don't know why, but I've always missed this. I've never gotten and actually preached a message on it. And as I started digging into it, I realized that I couldn't try to do it in 1 week. So it's going to be 2 weeks. So we're starting this week. But the giant's going to live until next week. Next week he gets, spoiler alert, it doesn't go well for Goliath. But anyways, in order to remind you, so we're looking at this ancient document, right? Samuel was written years and years and years and years ago. And 2,000 years takes us back to the time of Christ. Another 1,000 years takes us back to the time of the Davidic covenant. So we're talking 3,000 years plus. This story has been passed down for us. So it was trendy in our skeptical enlightenment age to say, oh, you know what, these are just all made up things and there's nothing real. But it's interesting how archaeology is kind of coming along and shedding light on some of the stories from the Old Testament. Some of the people and the movements and the nations, they're being fleshed out by archaeological research. And I wanted to show you this little video clip to kind of bring the reality of the Philistine people to your minds. This is from Harvard University. It's about 3 minutes long. I think you might find it interesting. So there, I don't know if you found that fascinating or disgusting or ambivalent, but I find it fascinating to see that dig dated to within the centuries around David's life. The Philistines were real people, and like he said, Philistine is often used as an insult. It's an insult, right? Like, oh, you Philistine, like you uncultured buffoon. But Philistines were quite sophisticated. They actually came from the north. They were known as the sea people. They probably came from the ancient Greece area, came down. They didn't do well with Egypt. Anyways, they ended up settling on what we now call the Gaza Strip. So when you hear about what's going on in Israel and Palestine, and you hear about the Gaza Strip and all the chaos there, that is Philistine land. That is their sliver of land. They don't exist anymore. There is no Philistine people per se, but this was their land. And for a big chunk of the Bible, through this era when David was alive, the Philistines were the big threat. They had five major cities. There was Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath. And Gath, of course, is where Goliath was from. And they attacked Israel constantly. So do you remember, those of you who are old enough, remember, I barely do because I'm so young, but remember the Cold War? And like, what was the defining tension in those years? Well, it was the tension between the West and the Soviet threat, right? And that was how you identified yourself as, you are not this. Well, Israel identified themselves in this era as they were not the Philistines. The Philistines were the threat that Israel was constantly at battle with. And here, in this moment, with David and Goliath, you get to see that story, that threat, that battle come to the forefront. So we're going to take the text in three chunks and unpack it as we go. And I hope by the end it might even challenge us in our lives today. So let's start reading in 1 Samuel 17, 1-11. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They were gathered at Succah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Succah and Azekah. Anyone else wants to take a crack at pronouncing these? You're welcome to. In Ephesdemim. Saul and the Israelites gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and formed ranks against the Philistines. The Philistines stood. Try to visualize this. So the Israelites formed ranks against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on the other side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the one, or the one, and then the other side, with a valley in between them. So you have two ridges of land. You have two armies. This is like Braveheart. Put that picture in your head, probably with the blue paint on the bodies. I don't know what their customs were. And they came out from the camp of the Philistines
a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span. So we're not quite sure what a cubit was, because everyone defines it a little bit differently, but we're essentially over 8 feet. So monster size. I'm 5'10". What's that? Does this make me Goliath size? I don't know. I'm certainly not as threatening, I don't think. There came from a champion in Goliath. He was 6 cubits in a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had greaves of bronze on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. It's interesting in scripture. You never get descriptions like this. They're doing this to build the tension in the story. You go into details about how threatening Goliath was. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. I always felt bad for the shield bearer. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw for battle?" You know what that means? Why did you even show up? This is smack talk, right? Am I not the Philistine? It says a Philistine in the New Revised, but the definite article's there. He's basically saying, am I not the Philistine? Like, I am the man. Why did you show up? Am I not the Philistine? You're just slaves of Saul. I imagine he spit at that point. Maybe this is just my imagination working overtime. Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight me and kill me, we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, today I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man that we might fight together. And when Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid.
Have you ever heard the expression existential threat? Existential comes from the Latin word that's used to describe existence. An existential threat is a threat that threatens who you actually are. It threatens your very existence. An existential threat is not, I have a cold. Even a man cold. An existential threat is something deeper than that. It's something that threatens your own conception of who you are. We're talking about the big things in life. We're talking about the loss of a loved one that threatens your ability to understand who you are. Or the disillusion of a marriage where one flesh is torn apart and you don't know who you are anymore. That threatens your very existence. The loss of a career, not just flipping from job to job to job if that's your pattern or that's what you enjoy doing, but someone, if you've been invested in a career track your whole life and you hit a point where you cannot continue in that, and you start to question, well, who really am I anyways? An existential threat is a life-altering illness or a disability that changes the way that you go about your life from here on in. Some of you have faced these sorts of threats. Others of you probably haven't. For most of us, they don't come along all the time, which is a blessing. But I think most of us, by the time we finish up this life, will have gone through one or two. One or two of these defining moments where we come face to face with who actually are we, with a threat that challenges our very existence. I've been speaking individually, but this can even happen on a corporate level. I had some conversations with one of the leaders of, First Baptist Church in town, just before they closed down. And I heard the agony in her voice as she was explaining the difficulty of finally giving up and closing the church that had been in existence for so long. These are called existential threats because they threaten who we are. And Goliath was Israel's existential threat. If Israel lost, they were driven out. If Israel won, they exist. Their story was, are we going to be slaves like we were in Egypt, or are we going to be a people? It threatened their identity of who they really are. So consider this scene now with that in the back of your mind. You have the armies on the hills with the valley in between them. The Philistines were more technologically advanced than the Israelites. They were more sophisticated in their technology. And when I say technology, I don't mean like iPods and stuff like that. The big technology in this era was iron. When you hear Goliath's description of his armor, he had bronze on his head, he had bronze on his body and on his legs, but the boasting was, and he had a spearhead made of iron. That was the technology. You've heard the difference between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, right? It's difficult, more difficult to make iron. But this was where Goliath was at. When I picture these two lines drawn up for battle, Israel was not a war machine. They were not sophisticated in the art of war. They were a loose confederation of tribes that had managed to live and eke out an existence in the Promised Land, some victoriously, some in a failing way. And they all came together because there was a common threat, but I kind of picture them with, you know, pitchforks and hay sticking out between their teeth, like, yeah, let's get this war going. And over on the other side, you have the Philistine war machine with its armor, with its sophistication, with its threat. And you have them preparing for battle. Goliath, like I said, was probably over 8 feet tall. His coat of mail weighed 130 pounds. It's a pretty heavy coat. Man, when I put on a 60-pound backpack, I feel weighed down, but I don't know. His spear was like a weaver's beam. That's just a big way of boasting. It would be like saying today he had a spear like a telephone pole. Right? Like it was monster size. The head, that iron head on the spear weighed 15 pounds. I've never tried to chuck a 15-pound spear. Well, plus the telephone pole behind it. He was so armored that he needed a boy to carry his shield. And like I said, that must have been the worst job in the world. We're going to war. Here, you stand in front and carry the shield. You got the 8-foot monster behind you with the going forward. A lot of the artwork shows the Philistine with the big shield in front of him, but truly the Bible tells us that he had a boy in front of him carrying it. He had the shield bearer. Consider the boasting, eh? Why'd you even show up? What a great way to demoralize the people. Why'd you even come to battle? I am the Philistine. You're just Saul's lackeys. Why did you even show up? And then he gives this empty bet. You know, defeat us and we'll be your slaves. Yeah, right. We know it's an empty threat. It's an empty bet because it doesn't happen. You defeat us, we defeat you. It was just all posturing. It was all talk. It was all boasting. And it had the right effect. It said that Israel were dismayed. That word means to be broken. They were broken. Their spirits were broken. Their ability to stand up towards this threat was broken. They were dismayed. They were greatly afraid. They were responding emotionally to the fear of that imposing figure of Goliath. Thankfully, I think most of the existential threats that we encounter don't take the form of 8-foot-tall Philistines with spears. But we still encounter threats. We still encounter those things I shared earlier. And those threats tend to boast. And they tend to wear us down. They tend to dismay us and break us and make us afraid. Like, there's no way you'll ever live without this. There's no way you'll be who you are without that. Who do you even think you are standing up to this battle? Because it's not going to happen. The threats that challenge us have the potential to break us as well, like Goliath broke the Philistines. Have the potential to make us greatly afraid, like Israel was greatly afraid before the Philistines. But in enters this shepherd boy, the shepherd boy messenger. And let's look at the next part of the story now, starting at verse 12 of 1 Samuel 17. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons.
You remember when David was anointed? All seven sons walked before Samuel, and God was like, nuh-uh. Isn't there someone else? And it was David. He had eight sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The three eldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul into the battle. They were warriors. And the names of his three sons who went into the battle were Eliab, the firstborn. Next to him, Abinadab. The third was Shema. David was the youngest. That's quite a contrast, eh? There's eight. So we talk about there's the three big warriors, Eliab, Shema, and Abinadab. And then there's the youngest, David. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, Goliath came forward and took his stand morning and evening. For 40 days they were threatened by this giant walking up. Jesse said to his son David, Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Take also these 10 cheeses to the commander of their thousand. I mean, this is fantastic. David's brothers are great warriors, and David's delivering cheese. Excuse me, sir, are you feeling peckish? Just some cheese. See how your brothers fare and bring some token from them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines, and David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the encampment as the army was going forth to the battle line, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David dropped his things with the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard them. And that's when the movie goes, dum, dum, dum. And David heard them. David was a humble little boy, right? Whether of his own choice or not. He came from humble circumstances. I love this. It tells us he wasn't even a full-time shepherd. He was a shepherd slash errand boy. His job was to run back and forth and make sure the battle was going okay and make sure his brothers were doing well. I look at him and I think his father, Jesse, says, David! He wasn't interested in David. He says, take this to your brothers and bring me back some token. I want to know they're okay. You almost get the impression that David's kind of overlooked at home. Go see your brothers. Bring me a token back. Let me know they're okay. But David goes and he hits the most exciting moment of his life. As he's going to the battle lines, he shows up, and I picture this, it's in the morning, right? So I picture the sun rising up behind the Philistine army. So the Philistine army all silhouetted by the sun behind them, and it's glowing. And David shows up, he sees that, and then he sees all the Israel army running to the battle line, shouting their war cry, trying to build up their confidence that Goliath crushes every day. And David's excited. He's like, yeah, he drops the stuff that he was supposed to deliver and he runs with the army to go see his brothers. And I picture their brothers just saying like, yeah, calm down, little David. We've all been here. Calm down, Davey. It's okay. And David's talking to the brothers and I picture the brothers kind of like trying to be not frustrated with David, but frustrated nonetheless. I imagine David's trying to speak to the brothers, but really he's like looking around. Look at that sword and look at the battle and go, what's going to get exciting? I imagine the excitement. David runs to the battle. I think to continue the idea of facing our existential threats, we can often feel small in the face of big circumstances, right? How can little old you face such a big threat? From my humble circumstances, from my background, how on earth can I do this? I had a moment in my class a couple of weeks ago. It was one of those moments where you're not sure if you can do the work that you're called on to do. And Dr. Zilla, he looked out at the class and he said, you know, you're probably going to have times when you question whether or not you can do the work, especially in this class when it's overwhelming and we're hitting you with all these methods and so on. You're going to wonder if you can actually do it. But here's the thing. We accepted you here because we know that you can do it even though you don't think you can. And it was like one of the most encouraging things I'd ever heard. It's like, okay, I can do this. And I think of David running there facing threats. I think of how we face threats. We might not be able to, we might not think we can handle what we truly can handle. And of course, with the Spirit of Christ within us, we can handle more than we could ever imagine. The last thing I want to talk about this morning is the last section of Scripture, verses 24 to 30. And it talks about the motives of David, because, you know, often we picture David as this angelic little boy who just goes to battle and does everything right. But I want to take a moment and think about his motives. And we're going to read this next passage of Scripture here. All of the Israelites, when they saw the man, fled from him and were very much afraid. The Israelites said, "Have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he's come up to defy Israel. Boy, the king will greatly enrich the man who kills him. He will give him his daughter and make his family free from taxes, essentially. Make him free in Israel." And David said, "What now?" This is what David overhears, right? Whoever defeats this Philistine is going to be rich, going to get the king's daughter in marriage, is not ever going to have to pay tax again. Sorry, let me say what? David perks right up, eh? David said to the man who stood by him, "What will be done? Tell me this again. What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine, who takes away the reproach from Israel?" And then David starts talking boastfully, like young kids do, to try to get his courage up. He's like, "What shall be done? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And so the people answered him in the same way. This is what will happen for the man who kills him. He'll be rich. You'll have the king's daughter as your wife, and you won't have to pay taxes. And I don't know what motivated David the most, but something did, because he asked about it twice. His eldest brother Eliab heard him talking to the men, and he got angry. The older brother hears the little pipsqueak saying, "What's going to happen?" And he can see what's going on in David's mind, right? Eliab's anger was kindled against David. He said, "Why have you come here? Who'd you leave the sheep with?" That's a good way of saying you don't belong here, eh? "Who'd you leave the sheep with to get here? I know your presumption and the evil in your heart. You've just come down to see the battle." David said, "What have I done? It was just a question." If you know brothers, this is very clear. He turned away from him, and I love this, toward another, and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. David heard it twice, but then after he's done arguing with his brother, he's like, "Okay, seriously, about the king's daughter, is that, like, really?" David asked three times about this. We have this idea that David is pure as the driven snow. I never understood that expression, but you know what I mean. David was this beautiful example of godliness, and he comes in as a humble boy with his trust in God and slays the dragon. That's a bit of baloney. David was full of mixed motives and confusing motivations in his heart. Let's look at a few of them. In the first part, he was motivated at least somewhat by riches, because he asked three times how much money he was going to get if he killed the giant. He was certainly pleased by the idea of tax-free status, and I think the king's daughter must have been a bit of a looker, because something made David want to take this challenge on. Maybe it was political motivation. Maybe David thought, "This is my way in." Maybe he had a memory of that day when the prophet anointed him and thought, "This is how I'll get into the family. This is how I'll work my way in." I don't know. But David had these mixed up motivations. There was a streak of racism in David. It's difficult to think of David in these terms, but you know what he calls Goliath? Uncircumcised Philistine. That's a racial slur if you've ever heard one. I could share what it might be equivalent to today, but none of you would want to hear it, and I would feel bad for saying it, so I won't. Uncircumcised is a nod to, you know what, uncircumcised Philistine.
there was this idea that the Philistines weren't really worthy to be considered. There was nationalism. There was a patriotism in David that motivated him. He says, how I want to take away the reproach of Israel. He was proud of his Israelite heritage, and he wanted to take away this reproach. There was also a bit of godliness. I'm not going to deny that there was godliness in David as well. He talks about the armies of the living God. How dare Goliath defy the armies of the living God? But then his brother pinpoints another one of his motivations. You just want to come here and see the battle. You just got bored with your sheep, so you wanted to see what's coming on down here with the Philistines. So there, we have five or six, depending on how you count, motivating factors in David's heart that the story tells us. He wasn't pure. He didn't come in saying, oh God, you and only you, with your strength I shall slay this giant and go forward and do the thing. No, he was like, the king's daughter, really? Tax-free status? That Philistine dog? They were Israel, come on. There was a lot going on in his heart. And I found this incredibly encouraging, because oftentimes that's the way we are as human beings when we're doing something for God, when we're challenging the threats that come our way. Oftentimes our motives aren't 100% pure. And I was thinking about how to explain this, and I think the best way is to embarrass myself. So I'm going to. So I have walked to church for the last three Sundays. I've gotten up an hour earlier, read more, prayed, and then I've walked to church and to be ready here on time for worship practice and so on. And if you ask me, why do you walk to church? Well, you know, the answer I would give you as well, it's a good time for me to pray. And that's true. That's true. I don't put my iPod on. And I walk and I pray. And I know if I walk to church, I have 45 minutes where I can just pray and pray for the church, pray about all sorts of things. Try to develop that conversational relationship with God we've been talking about on Wednesday nights. And that's true. But that's not the only motivation in my heart. That's not it. Sometimes I do it to clear my mind. Because when you go from a household with two kids that are fighting over who gets the screen on the computer, sometimes you need a break before you come and worship God and lead the people in the worship of God. You need that distance. So, yes, it's to pray, but it's also to clear my mind. You know what? It's also to exercise. I've been trying to lose a bit of weight and run a bit more. And I know if I walk to church before church and then I do this, it will add that much more activity to my life. So in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, that's a good way to get a good little bit of exercise in. I can walk to church. Probably the most humiliating motive is I love to feel like I'm on top of my game. I love to feel like I'm in control. I've been really analyzing myself for this message. I walk to church because I like to feel like I have my life in order and in control. And when I come here, I'm on top of it. And I know what I'm saying. And it's all there. And I'm not out of control. So why do I walk to church? Well, I do it to pray. And all these things. And I think if you examine, I hope I'm not the only one that's so horribly conflicted inside. I think if we examine our lives, when we face the challenges that come our way, oftentimes there will be all sorts of factors we can dig up. And I'm sure if I kept looking, I could find more reasons. But here's the thing. David was all mixed up in his motivations, and God blessed him. And he did what God called him to do regardless. And that's the same with us. Scripture speaks about us having a pure heart or an undivided heart. There's this beautiful little prophecy in Ezekiel I wanted to share with you, where God says, I will gather you from the peoples, and I will bring you out of the countries where you've been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. When they come here, they will remove from it all the detestable things, the idolatry, the abominations. But here's the center. I will give them one heart. Sometimes it's translated an undivided heart. I will give them a single heart. And put a new spirit within them. I will remove their heart of stone from their flesh and give them a heart of flesh so that they may follow my statutes and ordinances and obey them. They will be my people. I will be their God. The goal in the Christian life is to have a pure heart, an undivided heart, a single heart. But the reality is this mixed emotion thing is something that we wrestle with all the time. So I've learned that the best way forward, at least for me, is to confess my emotions before God. And that's what I was doing on my way. As I was walking to church this morning, I was praying, Lord, you know all the mixed up reasons I want to walk to church. But I want the real reason to be so that I can hear from you. So help me with all of the ways that my motivations don't line up properly. Give me an undivided heart. Give me a pure heart. I hate finishing the sermon while Goliath is still standing, because it feels unsettling. But next week, we will leave and Goliath will not. So next week, we continue. But just to remind you of where we've come up to now, we, like Israel, all have faced or will face an existential threat in our life. At some point, we'll have to deal with something so big that it challenged who we really are. Maybe you're in that moment now. And I think, like David, most of us will feel small and inadequate to the task before us. We'll feel like there's no way I can survive this. And when we go to battle, when we go to challenge that, when we go to follow God and face these existential threats, we come to realize that, like David, we have mixed motives and we have all sorts of interesting things come up in our heart. But what we can do now is pray and ask God to give us a pure heart, an undivided heart, and see what he'll do.